too. For a teensy bit after Father Marty's recruitment pitch, I felt like an ingrate for trying to think of reasons to deny what he had told me. I battled the question, how dare you not at least consider it, after all your faith has done for you. Catholic guilt never leaves you and follows you everywhere. It's the herpes of your conscience. But the more I thought about it, the more I wondered if the religion I was so devoted to was more of a hindrance to my growth as a man than it was helpful. Much of my own dedication to my faith stemmed from fear of God's wrath, in addition to the guilt and shame I suffered for harboring feelings that were in direct violation of God's will. I hadn't really challenged any of those beliefs until I was called upon to perpetuate them by joining the priesthood. Once I went back to school, I began to seek information about God and sexuality beyond the prejudices I had been conditioned to accept. In time, I just realized how spiritually unaware I was. With a better understanding of the history and the culture behind the words I used to cite for why I needed to never embrace or act upon my urges, I was reminded that the meanings of words can transform over time. Even the word abomination. And even if I were to disagree with that, technically all of the crawfish, shrimp, and crab I had been fed over the years made me just as hellbound, if not more so, than the gay sex I was in heaven. Then I reflected on my own immature ways of religion. Meanwhile, things never tempered down between my parents. My dad's anger and his troubling coping mechanisms never subsided, and I started to wonder increasingly whether religion kept my mom composed or captive. I admired her strength and faith tremendously, but I also speculated how much better her life might be if she focused more on what she could change now as opposed to waiting to be rewarded for her virtues in the afterlife. When you're suffering, faith can be an integral part of your survival. In my eyes, my mom was the strongest person in the world, and her religion had a lot to do with that. Even so, I didn't want to wait to die to live. I didn't want to keep bottling up who I was for the mere possibility that I might get a treat in the afterlife. Most of all, I never wanted to be in the position of causing some other person to feel as conflicted as I had been and continued to be. I did not want to join the likes of Ted Haggard and Eddie Long, who were revealed to be harboring the very same-sex attractions that they constantly condemned from their pulpits. Had I actually listened to Father Marty, I might have gone on to face similar ordeals. Funnily enough, by the time Bishop Eddie Long was accused by former male congregants of sexual misconduct, I had an essay published in which I called upon other Christians to consider placing homophobia among other biblically justifiable prejudices now deemed antiquated. Afterward, a college friend proceeded to email me what seemed like 2 years' worth of Bible study material. A year later, she found my new email address through my blog and wrote me again to say that she had met someone who prompted her to acknowledge that she liked women a whole lot more than she ever cared to admit. Despite the revelation, she closed her message with, "It's not something I broadcast. It's why I've always admired you. Being true to yourself is not easy." It is not easy, and at the time I was approached to be a priest, it proved to be pivotal. I may not have seriously considered becoming one, but I was at the point in my life when I could have sunken myself into a system that didn't embrace me as warmly as I once embraced it. A form of religion that would tolerate me, but only the parts of me that weren't affront to its misguided beliefs. The dangers in not using your God-given right of discernment were becoming painfully obvious. Although I was starting to open my mind and allow myself to see that not everything was as black and white as I assumed it to be, I wasn't exactly ready to let go of my religion completely or to publicly acknowledge my sexuality, but I was ready to figure some things out. Father Marty gave me the push I needed to finally start asking questions and finding answers independently. I knew in my heart that God was not the cock blocker so many of us would like to believe. I just needed to go out and prove it. The first, the worst. I should have known it wouldn't end well, because our first date consisted of us seeing Crash and dining at a vegan restaurant. Although chicken is always the ideal option, the meatless food was good and far more satisfying than the film. As much as I love Ryan Phillippe, his ass played a pivotal, defining role in my development. A film that examined racism and intolerance through narrative devices that recall various after-school specials was not especially fulfilling to me. In my immediate feelings after leaving the theater, I found the film well-intentioned but okay at best. However, as time went on, the flaws about it became all the more apparent and the experience of viewing it all the more regrettable. The same could be said about this dude. We were at the Regal Cinema near Union Square. A rat ran up the theater steps at one point during the film. Of course, my clumsy ass dropped my phone in the dark as the movie played. Technically, it was what I deserved for not having turned my phone off and opting to be present for the overpriced movie ticket that I had purchased. While he used the light from his phone to help me find mine, I desperately hoped that Master Splinter's ancestors wouldn't try to bite me and or steal the phone. In hindsight, the rat was probably trying to communicate the warning, "Run, bitch, run," to me about this dude. I first saw Jordan in passing while visiting with a high school friend who attended LIU Brooklyn. I was in New York to an interview for an internship, was a broadcast journalism major near the end of my sophomore year, and was determined to get an internship in New York. I had already done a stint at Magic 102 in Houston and another at C-SPAN before that. But I needed an internship that could be directly applied to my major to get the credit I needed to graduate. However, by the time I started searching for one, it was starting to sink in that I was far too opinionated to play the role of a traditional anchor. The veneer of objectivity in news was already fading, but not enough to convince me, the black man with an increasingly slick mouth and strong point of view, that there was space for me. So while I thought someone needed to carry on the legacy of the late Ed Bradley and rock a single hoop earring on 60 Minutes, I realized that I wasn't that person. Still, it was my major and I was not about to change it, which meant I needed to get it over with already, get my credit to graduate, and go about my business. After the interview, I linked up with Lawrence, who had attended the same high school as me, but was someone I knew more as the younger brother of a classmate. I was finally ready to flip my curiosity about sexuality into action, but I was still not officially out yet. I had heard about Lawrence being gay, so I decided to reach out. I had wanted to go to New York City for multiple reasons. I, like many others before me, had dreamed of being in the city. I was a proud Howard University student, but my initial goal had been to attend NYU or Columbia. I wanted to be in NYC, not DC. I wanted to be free and successful, and New York represented the epitome of both to me. However, we didn't have enough money for Howard, much less NYU or Columbia, which costs more than twice as much. I eventually found my way to Howard because when I saw how many black people I admired had matriculated there, I knew it wasn't a settlement of past dreams but a redirection into destiny. Upon greeting Lawrence, it quickly dawned on me that he was no longer just somebody's little brother and very much a young man. He also made it clear that he was gay. Interestingly enough, we never discussed my sexuality directly, but based on how he spoke to me and discussed plans on where we would hang out that summer, he had already clocked me and possibly presumed that I would be far more forthcoming in due time. After hanging out in his dorms for about 2 hours, Lawrence walked me out so I could make my train in time. That's when I spotted Jordan. If you asked me now who he looked like then, I would speedily say Bruno Mars. But Bruno Mars wasn't famous back then, so when I would describe him to friends at that time, I'd tell them that he looked like a spare DeBarge. He spoke to Lawrence in passing while walking wherever he was going, and I got on the elevator and went back to DC. I couldn't shake his face out of my head, but fortunately, I had heard his first name. It did not take long for me to comb Lawrence's Facebook friends and find him. Make note that this was Facebook in 2005. These young thots have no idea how good they have it now. Anyone can sign up for Facebook these days, including various democracy-soiling bots from a fake news factory based in Macedonia and founded by the Russians. Back then, you needed a college email address and the student loan debt that came with it in order to sign up for the service. I sent him a message that I had seen him. I mentioned how cute he was and that I was interested. He responded to my messages, but his responses were noticeably short. I was taking the hint, but decided to continue flirting for the sake of convincing myself that I was finally about this life and making real efforts to gain a footing in it. Not long after, Jordan shut me down by telling me that he was not gay. I gave myself credit for at least trying and then let it be. But days later, he circled back into my private messages, suddenly with an acknowledgement of having same-sex attractions and newfound interest in conversing with me. He says something about being private, and considering that I had hit him up out of the blue and only saw him in passing by way of a person who also lived in his dorm, he was somewhat suspicious. Discretion was one thing, but secrecy was its own type of monster. For the sake of my own interest in him, I leaned in on the idea that he was being discreet rather than secretive. We continued talking on Facebook, then graduated to texts, instant messenger, and occasional phone calls. He didn't give me a lot of information, but I thought he was cute. Damn cute. So cute that I decided to jump on a bus to go hang out with him in New York. I took a bus from D.C. to see him in New York literally a day before I was to fly back to Houston for a week. After that, I would return to New York for my summer internship, not at GMA, oh well. I probably could have waited until I was actually living in New York for the summer, but I really wanted to see him, and honestly, I wanted to finally go out with a boy. It was an impulsive move, but not the wrong one. After we ate that vegan food, he took me to the Christopher Street Pier. Then we walked up Christopher Street a bit more until it was time for me to catch my bus, pack my stuff, and take myself to Houston before coming back to New York for the summer. As we were walking back up, two things happened that should have signaled to me that he was probably not going to be the person I imagined him to be, or someone I needed to be around. The first thing was some very assertive woman, clearly a native New Yorker, surveying us and saying, "Y'all look good together." I smiled, looked at him, and said, "I like her." As nervous as I was, I laughed a lot with him and smiled the entire time. I wasn't out yet, and I wasn't sure what life as an admitted and eventually open gay man would look like. But in these moments, I felt the sort of assurance that I had been depriving myself of by not owning those feelings for so long. But then came the other thing. Jordan saw someone he knew and instantaneously became uneasy, as if he had something to hide. When I asked if there was a problem, he barely said anything about it. It was more like a gesture, a shrug, and it was not reassuring. I didn't have time to ask more because I needed to get back to D.C. During those summer months when I was in New York, it was difficult not only to get in touch with Jordan, but to also physically see him. He worked a lot. He was also taking summer courses. He was busy. Too busy for me anyway. When I did see him in the flesh, I was reminded of why I liked him. But if someone is really into you, they behave differently, more enthusiastically. I did meet other dudes in the meantime. There was one in particular who had also gone to Howard. He wasn't my type, but he was handsome, smart, and to some extent amusing, in that he was trying to convey a certain hardness. It was a sort of abrasive, traditionally masculine posturing in which overcompensating black men often engage. Given my background, that performative nonsense didn't draw much reaction beyond a chuckle. Like, "Bless your heart, little boy, you ain't hard, and even if you were, I am in no way shook." But since we had gone to the same school, I was open to dating when we got back to campus. He had different plans, however. The last time we hung out in New York, he informed me that he was not out on campus and had no intention of being so. He would not be dating men because he had other plans. Those other plans included pledging a fraternity and running for student government. He successfully did both, so I guess his plans worked out. As a consolation prize, he gave me head and threw that big country booty in the air. I let him blow me, but I did not go all the way with him. That was for a few reasons. First, I was a virgin, so in that moment, he was the first person to suck my dick. For that, I am forever grateful. Having said that, I operated under the belief that the first time I had sex would be with someone I cared about. Someone who would make an awkward experience on which I had no insight more comfortable to engage in. So, while I liked this dude, I liked Jordan far more. I kept in touch with Jordan when I went back to Howard. By early fall, I was back on his campus, albeit to stay with Lawrence and hang out with some more people I had met through him. When I went down to their cafeteria for breakfast, I saw Jordan. He spoke to me but was noticeably distant. I saw why. He had some kind of girlfriend. Claudia was introduced to me briefly by way of Lawrence. She was pretty, seemed really nice, and was Latina, which I would later learn was kind of a thing for Jordan. Jordan was a fake-ass Latino in that he was very much some country black boy from Long Beach, but had curly hair that kind of made him look ambiguous to people who didn't know the various ways in which black people can present. Even I wasn't all that familiar with these subtleties, so I recall asking, "Ain't your ass just black?" He was, but evidently he had a preference. I should have immediately written Jordan off after this, but I listened to his rationale. It was the kind that a no-good man in the black 90s romantic comedy gave. "Yes, she likes me, and we've hung out, but that's not a thing." She thought differently, of course, to the point that a few weeks later, I got a phone call from her asking if Jordan and I had some kind of thing. Who had said something to her? I assumed it had been one of Lawrence's gossipy friends. I never did get a definitive answer, but I covered for Jordan all the same. For someone who felt scarred by all the stereotypical images of gay black men that I saw in media, it was rather ironic and ridiculous for me to be a willing participant in a collegiate version of that god-awful down-low brother hysteria. But I wanted Jordan to like me. I wanted him to like me too much, till it came at the expense of my own integrity. Still operating from the house of idiocy, I invited Jordan to come to D.C. for Howard's homecoming. I had a plan in mind. I would rent a car in a hotel, we would hang out, party, get drunk, and then have sex. I knew he was far more experienced sexually than I was, so I was willing to let him, lead, and formally introduce me to homosexuality. I had a sneaking suspicion based on my porn searches which side of sex felt more natural, but I thought, I am falling in love with this person, and with love, I will probably like it from him. This is what happened when you listen to too many Mariah Carey ballads. By the time he got to D.C., I was under so much stress. I had experienced bad luck in landing in some of the classes I needed to finish my major, so I was taking 21 credits in order to graduate on time. I was also the president of the student chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, a position I had never wanted but had been pressured into taking because I was the most experienced person left in the organization. On top of that, I was a staff writer for the student newspaper, The Hilltop. As a result of doing too much, I rarely slept, had constant headaches, and was setting myself up for a fight with my body that I would undoubtedly lose. On the first night of our hotel stay, Jordan found me passed out in the bathroom. I had absolutely no idea what happened. I ended up blacking out again 2 months later at home, where I knocked my head on something. A cabinet? A sink? I don't know, I blacked out. And had to be taken to the emergency room because I was dizzy, couldn't see anything, and could barely talk. A CAT scan found nothing wrong, but I was told that my stress levels were extremely high and that I needed to cut back. The end result was me failing a math class and staying an extra semester that eventually became an extra year. The additional debt was far from appreciated, though at least I wasn't dead. On the next night of homecoming, we went to a club called Love. We had the best time until it ended with both of us being robbed at gunpoint. You see, before D.C. became gentrified beyond recognition, Love was located in an area, Northeast D.C., that wasn't especially nice. I had wanted to go ahead and pay to park in a lot, but Jordan said no, we could just park on the street. As someone from the hood, I was wary of this, but didn't want to argue about it. However, when he told me where to park, I did know that it didn't look like the safest place. It's fine. So fine that after leaving the club and going to our car, I turned around to see a gun in Jordan's face. Another man put one in mine. My initial thought was, fuck, I am a terrible date. I had gone from blacking out one night to a jacking the next. None of this was that sexy shit. Jordan was used to being robbed, though, as I later found out. I suppose they thought he looked like a member of B2K and was easy to rob. Okay, but don't drag me down with you. I gave them my wallet but kept my phone and the rental car keys, but they got everything Jordan had. When we got back to the hotel, I called my mom to tell her to cancel my credit cards. Hours later, she called to say she was surprised at how calm I had sounded. I told her, that's because I won all these scholarships and took out all these loans to go here, and I could have got robbed at home for free. As for the police officer, a black woman with a hairstyle that felt a decade too old but would have been cute for Halle Berry and Boomerang, she spent much of the time bemoaning how much she couldn't stand Howard and a lot of Howard students. I just got jacked at gunpoint, and you want to bitch to me about my bison brethren. Girl, give me this little piece of paper just in case I need to send it to my bank or credit card companies and fuck off forever. The next morning, Jordan and I woke up around the same time, and I had an idea. Teach me how to suck dick. He laughed at my phrasing, but while the act doesn't necessarily require instructions, he coached me anyway. I wanted to do more, but he said no. I wanted to have sex, but he declined. I was both offended and embarrassed. We went to the homecoming game after that. My friend Sarah, whom I will love forever, slid me $50 to get me through the rest of the weekend, and after the game let out, I took Jordan to the bus station and he went back to New York. Literally days after that, he fessed up that he was seeing someone else, not a woman this time, and that they were now official. I wanted to scream, why in the fuck did you come here then, you dumbass bitch? But instead, I just sighed a whole lot and tried to get myself off the phone. That should have been the end of him, but it wasn't. We still talked every so often. I still flirted with him, and sometimes he would flirt back. I still wanted to have sex with him. Several months went by, and I was back in New York for another summer of interning, Chris Rock had a comedy writing program with Comedy Central, and I was one of the lucky eight participants. I saw Jordan the morning I moved into the NYU dorm the network put us up in. He wasn't with that boy anymore, but as I later learned, he carried on with the same bullshit. With him, it was a lot of interest expressed whenever I wasn't in his physical presence. When I was, he would hold back or be completely disengaged. One of the few times we hung out around that time, he introduced me to one of his closest friends. I had met some of his friends before, but not any from back home. We went to karaoke, and they were surprised I had never done karaoke before. I hadn't because I hated the idea of karaoke, and after doing a rendition of the Isley Brothers' Between the Sheets and Slim Thug's verse on Beyonce's Check on It, I confirmed my disdain for it. Jordan took my karaoke virginity, and all I got in the end was another instance of gross disrespect. After a while, some Latino boy showed up, and you had to have been a blonde moron not to notice that this boy was into Jordan. "You wouldn't bring someone else you're talking to around me, would you?" I asked. Jordan said no, but then I saw them holding hands at one point. I wanted to grab my glass of cheap, well-browned liquor, gulp it down, and then crack that glass over his head. Instead of catching a case, I left abruptly. Before all this happened, I lent him a shirt to wear on his job interview. When he invited me to come get it back, I could make out the boy in the background in Jordan's bed. I told him he was a dishonest piece of shit, grabbed my shirt, and left. We didn't speak much after that. I went back to school. Although the extra year made me feel like I had failed a bit, at least I was able to graduate in a year that Oprah Winfrey was the commencement speaker. No, I didn't like her download theme conspiracy peddling, but it was Oprah. I loved Oprah. I could feel my credit score rising as she inspired us to go off into the world and let our purposes guide us. She told us not to worry, that we were in good hands because God had our back. That Howard teaches you to define yourself by your own terms and not by somebody else's definition. That there was no such thing as failure because failure was merely God's way of pointing you in a new direction. I applied this advice toward the future that awaited me in my professional life, but it was also something I wished to apply to my personal life. Jordan had left me feeling like a failure. I had accepted myself for my sexuality, but I wanted someone I found attractive to find me desirable in turn. I wanted an ideal setting to let go of my inhibitions and experience my sexuality in totality. I wanted to connect with someone emotionally before I connected with them physically. I wanted it my way. None of this was wrong per se, but my mistake was that I had been pursuing a man who had never been the person I had pretended he was. We had enjoyed moments in which we opened up with each other. When I told him about my chaotic childhood, he told me about his own issues with his father. When I told him that I wanted to be a successful writer who would go on to do all of these amazing things, he let me in on his dream of becoming a singer. I encouraged his dreams the way he encouraged mine, but I also worked harder on achieving mine. I had plenty of insecurities, but I didn't have as many as he did, particularly about being a gay man. If I was on the road to acceptance of self, I should not have been so eager to race after a man who was traveling in a completely different direction than I was. I was the only one trying to make something really happen, and I did this despite sign after sign telling me to let it go. I didn't feel like a failure for trying, but I did regret my reaction to what I perceived to be a failure. When I finally lost my virginity, it was to one of his friends. It was not the sort of gotcha that some people do in order to get back at a person they feel wronged them. What happened was I was back in New York job hunting, and while out with Maya, with whom I was staying, we went to a gay club. Given that Maya was one of the first people I told that I was gay, she wanted me to be in a space made for me. We drank, we danced, we drank even more as we continued to dance. Then I ran into Adam, one of Jordan's friends, and he joined us until Maya decided to dip. "Keep partying," is what she said. I asked about Jordan and how he was doing. Adam told me he was fine, but then nearly out of the blue, Adam told me that he had sex with Jordan and was very descriptive about everything they had done together. It infuriated me. I kept drinking. I didn't need to be drinking, as I was already drunk enough, but I had been given information that I wish I had never known. I don't remember what happened next, but I do remember the key points. I recall knocking out a bit on the couch at the club and Adam helping me get up while letting his hands linger in places they shouldn't have. Before we left, I asked for water. I don't remember drinking the water. All I remember is we were walking in some residential area nowhere near where I needed to be, and Adam was moving in to kiss me. I didn't push him off, but he had more in mind than just making out. A lot of the homes in New York have basements, so they also have steps that lead to that downstairs area. He took me into one such place, pulled my pants down, and repeated some of the very acts he had described doing to Jordan. I didn't want this, but I didn't stop him. He pulled my pants down farther, lowered me down, and quite quickly put himself in me. And with that, he took my virginity. I don't remember how I got home, but I remember feeling disgusted with myself. I hadn't enjoyed myself physically or in any other way imaginable. That was not how I wanted to lose my virginity. That was not the person to whom I wanted to lose my virginity. Hell, that wasn't even the position I wanted to be in sexually to lose my virginity. I wanted to be the one in control, and this was Thriller. None of this is what I wanted, and yet I had let it happen. I let it happen because I got drunk and drunker in reaction to information that, when it boiled down, had hurt my feelings. I am not excusing him for taking advantage of me. I am just disappointed in myself for never wanting to engage in that type of risky behavior only to do just that while inebriated and emotionally wounded. I told Jordan about it much, much later. He was bothered that Adam had told me their business and was apologetic because he knew that I wanted sex to be special. It may not have been his fault, but I resented him for everything else. He knew as much, and whenever we did speak, it would always go back to how I had been wrong. I said I had forgiven him, but I hadn't. He was still upset with me over some things I had told him in the heat of the moment. It didn't matter, though. We were not near each other, and it felt right to just go about our lives. I had no expectations of ever seeing him again, and that was fine. Unfortunately, because God loves to troll, I ended up being in the same metropolitan area as Jordan a couple of years later. For me, I was dream-chasing in Los Angeles, and for him, he was back home in Long Beach doing, the hell if I know. I learned this because of Facebook, where I should have had him blocked. But I can be so hard-headed sometimes. I reached out to him, and while texting back and forth, we decided that maybe we should hang out under the pretense that what had happened was in the past and we could just move forward. He did seem different in the ways in which he talked about himself and where he felt he was going. He was different in how he talked to me as well. Even when annoyed out of my mind with him, I had a habit of still being flirtatious. He proposed a plan, that we do what we hadn't done years ago in that hotel room. I professed a bit of shock that he would say this, but I let him know that it was fine with me. So we kept talking about it, which caused me to believe that while we may never be a couple, we could still act like one. In the past, I had always called him my fake boyfriend because he gave me the kind of grief you have with a trifling partner, but none of the perks. But now, the perks appeared to finally be on the horizon. It never happened. The day we were supposed to link, something came up. Something kept coming up. Then he fizzled away. He hadn't changed. Jordan was the same person with seemingly good intentions who turned out to be a self-centered jackass. The sort of person who would lead people on because they enjoyed the way someone made them feel. I conflated his ego with his having real feelings for me. I hated how he made me feel. I hated that he played me. I hated that in allowing him to play me, I played the hell out of myself. I hated that he only bolstered so many lingering insecurities in me. My talking to him, albeit infrequently, was my way of keeping the lines of communication open with the underlying hope that one day we could have that moment. But I was seeking validation from the wrong source. I kept trying to repress my anger at him by forcing civility with the hopes that he would give me something I wanted. Something I felt would help an awkward, humiliating situation make more sense. The mistake was to see it all for what it was. I had tried, and it hadn't worked out. I had tried way too hard and for too long when I should have let it go. All the same, I may have failed in losing my virginity in the way I envisioned, and I may not have gotten Jordan to want me as much as I wanted him, but I did learn from the experience. I couldn't make someone love me. I couldn't make myself desirable to someone who didn't want me. I couldn't compel someone to see me in the way in which I wanted to be seen. All I could do was be myself, and if someone didn't fool with it, find someone else. I didn't quite master that with dudes that came after Jordan, but with him, I reached a place where I could let him go. By dumb luck, I saw him again years after that exchange that had led to nothing. I'd finally moved to New York as an adult, rather than merely spending time there for a summer to intern or as some frequent visitor. I was standing in line for a concert when I saw him walk towards the end of it. Our eyes met around the same time we both spoke. By then, I no longer carried that same degree of hostility. He apologized many times for things that he'd done and said, but mostly for how he made me feel. I had heard some of these same apologies in the past, but I hadn't thought he truly meant them. By then, though, I decided to stop giving so much energy to him and what did and did not happen with us. I let him wait in line with me and the friend with whom I had come to the show. He let me know that his boyfriend would eventually be joining him. He wanted to let me know that he had someone. Maybe he had a flashback to past acts of foolishness that would have got him popped. Whatever the reason, gold star for him for having a man, but that didn't matter anymore to me. His appearance had changed, but he remained cute enough for at least a hate fuck. I snapped out of it. Once we both got into the venue and the concert started, Jordan and his boyfriend stood near us, but I didn't look their way. I wanted to enjoy the show in front of me rather than fixate yet again on a distraction. Diana Ross. I didn't know there was a national coming out day until my late 20s. This makes sense, given that the holiday had been conceived the decade I was born. It also doesn't help that I wasn't brought up in an environment that would welcome such celebrations. The same can be said of society at large. After all, the first president I actually paid attention to was Bill Clinton, the architect of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We now live in an age in which social media magnifies the most trivial of celebrations, such as National Pancake Day or National Chicken Wing Day. To be fair, chicken wings are one of the greatest gifts to the modern carnivore. So thankfully, in the midst of learning about celebrations like National Jalapeno Popper Day, and You Can Remember Buying Cassette Maxi Singles Day, I also learned about days like National Coming Out Day. Perhaps this is how a lot of folks feel about Juneteenth, which I learned was not as commonly known outside of Texas as I thought. However, no one challenges that day after learning about it. Yet every single October 11th, some bemoan the necessity of the occasion in the first place. The critics all use different phrasing to plead their case, but their arguments are all roughly the same. Why does anyone need to come out? Straight people don't come out, so why should anyone else? Why is it anyone's business anyway? Doesn't National Coming Out Day help perpetuate the notion that heterosexuality is the norm? Aren't members of the LGBTQ SWB community much safer now than the past? It's the most annoying pop quiz ever. Non-straight people come out because the world continues to render everyone straight until otherwise noted. Straight people don't have to come out because there are more of them than there are of us. It's not anyone's business, and no one is obligated to hold a press conference to reveal their sexual orientation. But in terms of visibility and raising awareness on a human level, coming out continues to matter. As for being safer, that depends on who you are and where you are. Even in this country, which, with the assistance of voter suppression, sexism, racism, xenophobia, a hostile foreign government, and a complicit for-profit media, elected a bigot who, in the past, may not have been overtly homophobic or transphobic, but like the opportunistic, careless person that he is, quickly sacrificed our safety and our basic human rights for his political interests. I largely hear complaints about National Coming Out Day only from those who may not necessarily be in the closet, but who nevertheless don't overtly profess their sexuality for careerist reasons. That, or they're people who see society through the lens of an early 1990s Mariah Carey ballad rather than seeing the horror flick directly in front of them. So yes, National Coming Out Day continues to matter. The day Diana Ross's I'm Coming Out stops slapping at a gay bar is the day we band together and put National Coming Out Day in rice. Not a second sooner. I myself came out in stages. By the time I had settled in New York to intern for the summer, I went ahead and told Lawrence directly what I had only alluded to mere months beforehand. Not long after that confession, Lawrence took me to my first gay club, Luke and Leroy's in the West Village. Back in high school, quite a few of my friends, mostly lesbians or bisexual girls, used to go to this club in Houston called Big Yo's. The club used to advertise on television, specifically during BET's Uncut, which played music videos that in no way could air during daytime or even prime time, like Black Jesus' What That Thang Smell Like, or on the local public access station, which played all the Southern rap videos that were not getting national airplay. The club was technically 18 and up, but like many gay clubs of yore, if you had a fake ID, knew how to present older, or frankly, the person at the door didn't give that great a fuck, you could routinely get in. I never went though. My mom was strict and enforced an oppressive curfew. As for sneaking out, well, we had burglar bars on the door, so it wasn't exactly easy to do. My brother sure tried, and he got popped in the mouth a few times as a consequence. So, having absolutely no experience in a gay club before this night out with Lawrence, I immediately expressed confusion to him over the scene before me. Two hurly-burly dudes dancing in the dark with each other. To which Lawrence replied, "Fool, we're in a gay club." And we would go to this club every Thursday night, me stupidly using the credit card I had no business owning in order to drink excessive amounts of alcohol. Part of this was to loosen me up, but much of it was rooted in my attraction to Chris the bartender. Chris the bartender went to Princeton, where he majored in mechanical engineering. I knew this because when I wasn't dancing excessively to Destiny's Child Lose My Breath, to nearly every song in Lil' Kim's catalog, and thankfully, to selections from the Snap Music era, I was talking to Chris the bartender. Chris the bartender told me he was straight, but he thought I was funny, and I thought he should have my babies, so I kept talking to him. I also tipped well, which explains why he both engaged with me and sometimes gave me extra alcohol or free shots. I convinced myself that he loved me, but that he was afraid of commitment. Once, I left the club for a second and returned with a ring pop to propose to him. He was flattered, but I am not married. We became Facebook friends, if that's anything. As all of this was going on, I completely avoided all my friends from Howard. Most of them were women. I imagine they had their suspicions about me, given that I had never tried to smash any of them, and the only woman I talked about with any enthusiasm was named Beyonce. Still, I didn't feel ready to confirm their suspicions. That all changed, however, after the way I carried myself during the Pride events that same summer. I initially had an aversion to going and was practically coerced into doing so. I was so petrified of being found out, and lo and behold, it happened within minutes of my being there. There were so many different folks from so many separate parts of my life. More people from high school, people from college, people from the Taylor Michael Scholarship Program, founded by Magic Johnson, for which we were flown out from separate cities across the country and housed together for a week. And all of them randomly popped up on me, one after the other. I remember being at the Christopher Street Pier laughing and smoking a black and mild with Lawrence and his friends when I saw a bunch of folks from our high school heading our way. I immediately took off. I had always regretted not running track in high school, and the speed with which I sprinted away yielded another reason why. I knew that if they saw me, they would report me to people back home, and it would get back to my brother, who I had heard was gay too. Despite our closeness in age, we were not especially close at the time, so I didn't bother inquiring further about him, and I didn't want him to know anything about me either. It may have been my own paranoia, but I feared that he would run off and tell my folks. After escaping, I ran into the girl from the scholarship program who, almost immediately upon meeting me 2 years prior, had kept making pointed remarks about my sexuality. She was sitting on a step on Christopher Street. She used to whisper behind my back to our shared group of friends in the program. Some defended me, some didn't. Most didn't care either way. The irony was that, as much as she worried about me, I had a sneaking suspicion that she was gay too. I suppose fixating on me was a solid way to deflect from her own struggle with accepting her sexual identity. Yet here she was, standing before me with a smug grin on her face. Initially, I thought to speed by, but after quickly turning my back to her, I stopped in my tracks. It was then that I asked myself what exactly I was running from. Better yet, was I really about to let this messy motherfucker have one over on me? For as much shame as I still carry with me, I did not like other people thinking they had something on me. I'd known I liked boys since being caught at daycare trying to get this boy to show me his little cupcakes. Of all people to hide it from, it was not going to be her. Now, here on Christopher Street, I walked up to her directly. "Hi, now you have it confirmed." She feigned shocked and reached for a hug. I gave her fake ass the fake ass church hug she deserved. Then I went back to the pier to apologize for scattering away like a damn fool. While walking back, I spotted someone I knew from Howard. I walked up to him with a smile on my face. "Hey, don't you go to Howard?" He ran from me as I ran away from others minutes prior. It hurt, but I understood it. I'd almost done the same thing back to back. While I was interning at MTV, there was a girl there named Brooke who had worked as the executive assistant for the president of MTV News. The day I started that internship, I got on the wrong Q train and headed to Brooklyn rather than 1515 Broadway. I still managed to make it to work on time, but the head of the news division sat me down and said, "Give me a few minutes, I'm going to get you settled." He never did. I had to find my own work, so I walked around the office and constantly asked people what they did and how I could be of use. While doing my routine tours, I finally talked to Brooke. From then on, I was constantly walking by her desk. I didn't know what it was about her, but I felt more comfortable with her than I did some of my actual friends. During one of our chats, she randomly inserted that I should just be free. Usually, I would dismiss that as some hippie jargon to which my cynical ass couldn't relate. However, in that moment, I just smiled. The woman had a point, and the more I thought about that nugget of advice, the more eager I became to apply it. That led to me finally deciding to tell one person from Howard about my sexuality, Maya. I asked Maya if she wanted to go to lunch, and we went to Sylvia's in Harlem. It's still the only time I've ever eaten at Sylvia's, despite the fact that I've lived by it for years. There, over catfish and macaroni and cheese, I stumbled over something I had fought to say out loud for all of my life. I'm gay. Oh, I knew that. My mom is a psychiatrist. Girl, that is not the response you're supposed to give. Now, I imagine what truly tipped her off, you know, besides whatever mannerism she deemed obvious, obsessing over the first half of Dangerously in Love, not hearing anything about my dick in some Howard girl's vagina, was when I once heard a very loud display of homophobia in class and promptly raised my hand to shut the dumb shit the fuck down. Right at the start of the fall semester, I told a second person from Howard, Nikisha, another I forever will adore. We were in the iLab and she wanted to know why we didn't hang out. After I told her, she playfully slapped my face and said, "Duh, why didn't you tell me? We could have went to the gay clubs together." I love my friend dearly, but for future reference, duh is not the preferred response. You don't have to feign shock, although sometimes a little theatrics helps, but generally speaking, you never know what anyone is until they tell you explicitly. Even if Keish has seen me doing the bunny hop, a dance, non-Southerners, on the rainbow flag while juggling dicks, as a courtesy, I would prefer to be given the benefit of the doubt. Then again, she is from the Bay and has fully functional eyes. There's only so much I can ask of a good friend. After a while, Lawrence went back to Houston for a break, and I was going to Luke and Leroy's, as well as other gay clubs in the area, solo dolo. In hindsight, I should have brought Nikisha, as she was bait for gay men. I got more surprising remarks from other classmates, one of whom expressed immediate disappointment because she thought I was cute. A few more echoed that sentiment, but I was like, when I tried, girls, y'all didn't want me, so let me just work through this boy thing I've been bottling down since Chippendale Rescue Rangers. My coming out became more real when I told one of my best friends back home. Kimmy, I'm gay. Kim expressed legitimate shock, but as expected, delivered a sharp, memorable response. It was that bitch Alicia, wasn't it? I had to explain to Kim that while it did feel like Alicia had run over my heart with her Dodge Neon, that was not how it worked. After that, she just accepted it, as did the other friends from high school with whom I maintained contact. I told my friends first because they were my chosen family. That's not to say that I didn't love my family, but I had also gone far away from Houston for college for multiple reasons. The one large motivating factor was escaping what had always felt like an environment mired in chaos. My brother did hear about me and called me about it. At first, I told him to mind his own fucking business and that he didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. Knowing that response was mean as hell and totally unwarranted, I called him back, apologized, and explained the truth calmly. I do not like to be met with gossip, much less from my own brother. The family member whose opinion mattered most to me was my sister Nicole. I was and am obsessed with my sister. Growing up, she was 9 years older than I was, but because our mom often worked long hours overnight or 12-hour day shifts, my sister had a large hand in taking care of us. I can barely put into words how much I fell before the altar of my big sister. My appreciation for music came largely from diving into her massive CD collection. My appearance grew majorly from her helping me shop. My parents were incredibly hard workers, but the way my sister managed to get pregnant at 22 with my oldest niece, continue to have both a full-time job and a full course load, and still graduate with good grades inspired me beyond belief. How she continued to work tirelessly as others failed in their responsibilities left me in awe. And she cared so much for her children and worked relentlessly not to repeat any of our parents' mistakes. We were both so hard on ourselves, but she was nothing short of impeccable. So if she had not accepted my being gay, it would have broken me. I didn't tell her until a year after I told my friends and my brother. I was back in New York on a random trip to see Jordan. At some bar, drunk and tired, I let the liquid courage direct me to call my sister out of the blue to tell her the complete truth about me. Sensing my anxiety, she said, okay. I mean, I kind of wondered at one point, but I wasn't totally sure. Are you all right? I wasn't sure if she was in total acceptance in that moment, but the fact that her main concern was whether or not I was okay was another reason why I love her so much. Today, I still talk to her more than any other member of my family. My parents were another story. My friends were top priority. My sister was next. My parents always knew that conversation would be difficult, so I waited and waited and waited some more. A few years went by before any discussions were had about it, and each time, I felt that the chat stemmed from coercion. As for my father, he asked about my sexuality in a way that would have been unsurprising to anyone who had ever met him. He pulled me to the side in the living room of the house in which I had grown up and asked me if I was funny. When he uttered the word funny, his left hand moved swiftly side to side. This country-ass way of describing homosexuality immediately turned me off. My first instinct was to repeat the hand gesture and declare, "I'm hilarious." But I did something else instead. I didn't confirm or deny. This was not about denying who I was. It was about punishing a man who I felt made all of our lives a living hell. Of course, remembering how he talked about his own brother, I was not sure how he would handle the news. But I did have my suspicions. He will blame my mother. He will get angry. He will say something hurtful. He will piss me the fuck off. We might likely fight. As an adult, I had to be separated from him once after calling him a bitch to his face over the way he spoke to my mother. Between his volatility and my repressed anger issues, one shaped squarely by him, that would have ended very badly. The same can be said for this line of questioning. Even so, none of this was my ultimate concern or why I didn't say anything one way or the other. I knew he knew. He knew that I knew that he knew. I just looked at him with utter disdain for asking me because I knew it would hurt him. All I said was, "I don't like anything," and added that no matter if I was the gayest or the straightest man within a 20-mile radius, I didn't owe anyone an explanation, and that I would tell my mother anything before I told him. He would complain that my sister and I hated him, and that we only talked to our mother. Never did he make note that his actions may have led to such allegiances. I let years go by before telling my mom. What prompted my doing so was the publication of an essay that I had written about two young boys who reportedly committed suicide within the same month after being bullied for being gay. This was before the It Gets Better movement. These were two young black boys, and the world wasn't often as responsive to their needs as it was to those of white kids. For The Root, I wrote about my own history of taunts over being gay and how I wish I could have told each bullied boy that he would overcome these challenges. Back then, The Root had a relationship with MSN, and some of my pieces would be picked up on their homepage, sometimes only for a few hours. But in the case of this essay, it was up for much of the whole day and squarely in the center of the homepage. MSN site used to be my mom's homepage. I wasn't certain, but I had strong belief that it was likely she would see the piece, read it, and be disgusted. Such reasoning was why the piece almost hadn't happened, in fact. My editor had me speak to a colleague at the site, another gay black man, to gauge whether or not I was ready for the potential consequences of publicly outing myself in my work. By the time he called me, my decision was already made, and he picked up on that quickly. The piece went live. I called my mom. Her reaction was one I will never forget, one I wrestled with forgiving her for. "So what are you trying to say to me? That you're gay?" "Yes." "Well, that explains why you and your brother's lives have gone the way that they have." Of all the hurtful things she said to me, that I was a self-centered bastard for wanting to go away for college knowing we didn't have the money, she apologized after I confronted her about it later, or that I would end up alone, this was the most hurtful. Also didn't know what in the hell she was talking about. Was I rich? No, but by 25, after the Great Recession and media imploding as the shift to digital occurred, I was managing to support myself with my words. I had made an appearance on national TV for my work and was continuing to build my career. I was not without struggle, thanks to my oppressive private student loan debt, but those struggles did not mirror my brother's. Not to mention, those struggles had absolutely nothing to do with sexuality. If anything, many of them were influenced by the man she decided to keep lying with, not the other way around. She had her fucking nerve to say otherwise. My mama went on to express disappointment about likely not having grandchildren anymore. I noted that technology could fix this, but she promptly dismissed it. After that phone call ended, I didn't speak to her for months. I imagine she worried about my health. I'm sure she felt that as a black man in this world, I had enough problems. Why further complicate them? I wish she had said that while she didn't agree with my lifestyle choices, she at least hoped that I would be safe. I wish she had said anything besides what she had actually said. She was cold, mean, and condescending. I wanted to curse her out, outline detail by detail how she was nowhere near the sort of Christian she thought she was, and tell her to never talk to me again. I'm glad I didn't stoop to her level in that moment, as much as I wanted to. By the time we spoke again, neither of us brought up what had previously been discussed. A few years later, someone asked me if I could choose to be straight, would I? I thought about it for a second and started to lean toward one answer, but then looked up and saw a man walking down the street in basketball shorts and an undershirt that I still need to quit calling a wife beater. He had a Caesar, his sleeve was tatted, and he was just the right level of shortness I tend to go for. In full-fledged creep mode, I told my friend to hold for a second so I could watch him. As soon as I looked down at his ass, I quickly turned around and said, "Nah, I'm good with gay." But I never forgot the hurt I felt by my mother's words. It further strained an already strained familiar dynamic and had an impact on me in ways I wouldn't realize until much, much later in my adulthood. As a gay man, you already have so many people against you. Your family, especially your mother, is supposed to be in your corner as you battle these people, not throwing sucker punches along with them. As hurt as I was, it did not stop me from becoming more personal in my work. If anything, it lit a fire under me to advocate even more for those like me. Those who face similar struggles, those who worried that their mother, the most important person in their lives, would be disappointed by something that's beyond our control. Folks can feign that the world is much more progressive than it is, but my story still mirrors that of far too many others. Thus, there is the need to continue sharing it and to push the same acceptance of others. Not everyone else has to do this, but for those of us who do, we know why we have to. We are worthy of acceptance, but far too many continue not to view us or treat us as such, notably those with power. We can't shut up until they do. You will die poor. It was becoming painfully apparent to me that I needed to get out of Houston. The sooner the better. It was fall 2008, and I was full of frustration and feeling like the biggest fucking failure. I graduated from Howard a year later than I was supposed to. Pro tip. Try not to overexert yourself by cramming 21 credits a semester into your senior year in addition to holding a staff writer job on the school paper, being president of the student chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, taking algebra at the very last minute knowing damn well that mathematics is the arch villain of your life as a student, and having the nerve to start blacking out and having a bunch of weird health problems. It won't end well for you. I didn't get a job immediately after college. Well, I did eventually get a job offer to work with one of my favorite people in media ever, Danielle Smith, as her assistant. Only when she told me that she might be leaving her position at Vibe 2 months after my start date, I punked out. I got a letter saying I would be owing $800 a month in private student loan payments, and after comparing that with the offered salary, I took the advice of my family members who don't work in media and declined the offer after accepting it. Annoyed Danielle, we're better now, I love her, and ended up living at home for a year and a half trying to fight off their suggestions I go do something else like teach or anything else besides media. I was scrabbling freelance jobs together and constantly hounding people's inboxes searching for an in, a job, a writing contract, a referral, whatever would help advance my goals. But after more than a year back home, I was feeling lost. I needed to be someplace where I could realistically pursue my dreams. If I waited too much longer, I was going to need to get fitted for a straitjacket. Such fears led me to reluctantly taking Lauren's offer to rent a room in her 4-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles. Shortly before leaving, my Uncle Terry stopped by to give me some advice and to confirm that I was making the right decision to stop bullshitting and leave Houston again. I hadn't seen that much of Uncle Terry as I grew older. Indeed, I didn't see much of my dad's family at all, sans a few relatives every few years. But Terry always made his presence felt somehow. I was in bed, recovering from the previous night of cathartic debauchery, when I heard him, his voice, loud as hell, talking to my brother Marcus. At the time, my brother worked for the county, and that got Terry excited. He made the following declaration. "Man, the next time they take me downtown, I'm going to say, my nephew works upstairs, let me out this motherfucker." He was always a man with a plan, but a loud plan that woke me up. He asked Marcus where I was, and Marcus told him that I was asleep. Shit, I'm gonna wake his ass up. Too late for that, Uncle Terry. I wanted to fake being asleep or play dead, but I knew that he was usually fresh out of dams and was unlikely to spare one in this instance. The light was turned on as I heard Uncle Terry shout, "Nigga, wake your ass up." I didn't recognize him. In this moment, he looked a lot like Rick James. However, he remained very much the same Uncle Terry who, as legend has it, once introduced a former-in-law to one of his girlfriends as "that bitch that broke up my brother's marriage." The same Uncle Terry who, after finding out that I had graduated from Howard University and was trying to launch a career as a writer, asked, "When you gonna work in a building?" Shortly thereafter, he asked me to burn a couple of movies for him on DVD. He looked like he was about to sing Mary Jane at any moment, but it was the same hysterical, slick-mouthed Uncle Terry, still committed to looking like Rick James. "What you doing still asleep? You must have been partying all last night." I answered, "Maybe," only to add, "I probably got that from you." Uncle Terry laughed. He took my smart-ass response as a compliment to his own smart-ass comment, the family way. He told me my dad had mentioned something about L.A. and asked what had happened to my plans about moving to New York. I explained that I thought California might be the better option for me for the time being, and his face lit up as if I had pulled out a blunt. He then told me that L.A. was fast and that I should be careful. "Man, there's so much damn pussy out there, they just throw it to you." I planned to bob and weave from the pussy and the conversation he wanted to have relating to it. He promptly added, "But man, don't get married, just hit and run." Uncle Terry asked if I was going to sleep, but he didn't care to hear the answer because he already had a request. "Bring your ass outside and meet my people." I wasn't sure what these people were going to look like, given that before entering my room, Uncle Terry had boasted to Marcus about how he still got young hoes of around 21 years old. Outside, I saw a woman with a weave on top of a weave and gold teeth. No judgment from me on that. I'm from Houston. Who doesn't have gold teeth? I did wonder about the other girl, who had nails as long as the ones Coco from SWV used to wear, though. I was curious to know if she could claw the shit out of me if I offered her one foul look. I leaned toward an emphatic yes, and that she had the edge because, even standing a few feet away from me, her thumb could reach my cornea. I also briefly wondered if she owned a bidet, but just as soon realized that it wasn't any of my business. I don't remember their names. I'm not convinced Uncle Terry does either. Lovely ladies, though. I hope everyone had a good time. Terry let me go, and I crawled back into bed, where I text Lauren and thanked her for lovingly giving me the push to leave home and truly pursue my dreams, a friend and a roof included. Upon my arrival in L.A., I realized that the four-bedroom apartment came with a bit of an asterisk. The place as a whole was indeed huge and cheap, but as far as bedrooms go, my room was more like a teensy office where you could fit a mattress. But it was better than sleeping at my mama's house. The place was in Koreatown. K-Town wasn't exactly one of L.A.'s finest attractions. It sure wasn't the safest. One of my new roommates informed me that a couple of months prior to my moving in, someone had died right around the corner from our building during a gang initiation. Apparently, the victim was set on fire on the sidewalk. I knew what being held at gunpoint was like. Someone who lived up the street from me, dying at the hands of another, was also not anomalous to my background. But, someone being set on fire on the sidewalk? That actually did make me regret not learning how to keep a blade under my tongue that one time this girl led a demonstration in 9th grade during Algebra 1. It was not lost on me how, despite living in Koreatown, I rarely, if ever, spotted a Korean in our part of Koreatown. I would have described this area as Diet Hood or Hood Zero. My neighborhood in Houston was more overt in letting you know that we were in the hood. Angelinos, forever dedicated to appearing too cool at all times. So yes, a little perplexing at first, but I thought, I ain't new to this, I'm true to this. Thus, it didn't take long for me to survey my surroundings and learn the basics. Knowing which streets were safe to frequent and which ones probably weren't the wisest choices to venture out to after certain hours, clocking that the house across the street from us might be a good place to get drugs, but never forgetting how that was none of my business. Unfortunately, there was a jolly round fellow across the street who lived in that very building who routinely smiled and waved at me whenever he spotted me en route to the gym or the grocery store. I guess maybe he wanted me to be his boo thing? He had Desi Arnaz's smile and Nino Brown's business sense. As he was the resident drug dealer of the block, I suppose both qualities were perceived as strengths. Outside of gawking at me as if I was scrumptious when topped with horseradish, he never actually bothered me.